You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
My name is Dharmendra Kanani. I'm Director of Strategy at Friends of Europe and your moderator for this first session. A very warm welcome to you to this, what we've built as Europe's Climate and Energy Outlook, now that the ink is dry on COP22. The Paris Agreement 1 year on, and how do we turn wish lists into practical action? We have a really interesting cast list for you this morning, covering various vantage points of this debate and on this issue. What I'm going to do is ask our first two speakers to go before we take a short break for questions and some quick reactions from you, just to break up the morning and also to make sure that we're all awake on this unusually sunny day in Brussels, another example of global warming weather. Just by way of introduction, it's quite clear that as we think about moving wish lists into practical action, it's evident that the forces of supply and demand will play a huge, huge role in this debate. But I think a third element will also add to this, which is accountability in its various forms, whether that's through regulation, through governance, target setting, will also play a part. And ultimately leadership at all levels, both at the international, national, and even the local level, will matter. And civil society in particular will be a key driver in this debate too. As a part of our approach to thinking about this session, we thought we might bring the voice of citizens into this room. We have a debating platform called Debating Europe, which has over 2 million unique visitors every month, which we use to engage citizens across Europe on issues of the day, on policy matters, and connect them to policymakers. And we looked through our previous debates on this agenda, and we picked out two, which I felt could serve us well to frame our conversation. Only two. And so there's one from Rui from Spain. And he says, "It's never too late to address the problem seriously, but the best time to plant a tree is always 20 years ago. When the impact of climate change is being felt, citizens will be angry that more wasn't done sooner." And then the second, which I think I'll use as an intro to our first set of speakers, is from Pradeep in the UK. And he says, "Paris can certainly be regarded as an achievement, but more important is implementation and monitoring. Countries can talk the talk, but now they must walk the walk." On that note, can I invite Norbert Gorilla to say a few words? Norbert, I'm particularly interested in the role that you've played in using the presidency to escalate and advance this particular issue. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moderator. Good morning to all, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. It's really a pleasure for the Slovak presidency to be represented here at this distinguished panel. And straight towards your question, I think the Slovak presidency played a really crucial role. I would say, in other words, even instrumental.
Okay.
Because as some of us would never expect that basically EU ratification process could overrun the national ratifications, and basically compared to the previous time when we had a Kyoto Protocol to tackle, it took us 7 months to ratify it on the global level, whereby during the Slovak presidency we managed actually to ratify the biggest ever global legally binding agreement within a few months, within 9 months, I guess. So there was many things that actually needed to be consulted, coordinated, but overall this feeling that we need to move forward and that we need to align ourselves with a future-proofed, low-carbon, climate-resilient and resource-efficient Europe was basically very very, very, very dominant in our thinking. And of course, the global development that, of course, Chinese and American friends have put us under certain pressure, we decided to do almost impossible that some of would think and manage the thing on the 30th of September, where we convened extraordinary council meeting in Brussels, and then of course jointly working with the European Parliament, we managed to get the EU ratification through on the 4th of basically on the 5th of October, and then the official depository had happened on the 7th of October in New York. But it's not only about the Paris Agreement, which is of course the absolute top, but there were also some other very serious achievements, especially related to the recent adoption of amendment of Montreal Protocol, which actually just happened last week in Kigali, where we demonstrated this is the way how to implement the Paris Agreement, because the HFCs, they represent half a degree effort, which is huge. In my thinking, it's the one of the lowest hanging fruit that we were able to tackle, and we made it, of course. And the Slovak presidency was kind of in the management jointly with the Commission to deliver on ambitious HFC phase down. On top of it, there was also another global achievement in relation to ICAO. We also got a global regime to tackle through market-based instruments aviation emissions, and it also happened on the 7th of October in Montreal. And last but not least, perhaps it's less relevant for climate, but also Johannesburg CITES meeting was also very important. But now I think there is no time for complacency. We have achieved a lot. We triggered the agreement, and EU was really instrumental in making the agreement a reality. We are very happy for it, but it's no time for celebration. I think it's time for real work, and now it's the period where we have to really invest a lot of effort to deliver on concrete results, to stay on track, and to try to, you know, deliver the, of course, even more than or lower than 2 degrees Celsius pathway. We had just recently, last Monday, a very good discussion on non-ETS regulation, so-called effort sharing regulation, which is, of course, one of the cornerstone of our climate policy. We had a very good debate in the Council. It proved that actually the targets are set at a reasonable level. However, few further flexibilities needs to be more explored in greater detail. But however, I would remain confident that staying with non-ETS and ETS on this, you know, on the same expeditious mode, I think we can also deliver on the concrete commitments in relation to Paris Agreement. One word on the emission trading scheme, which is the instrument to deliver emission reduction the most cost-efficient way. During the Slovak presidency, we aim to ground or to set the foundations in the Council in a way to adopt a so-called general approach to prepare for negotiation with the European Parliament. So just to maybe conclude that we stay very ambitious. We want to have concrete deliverables. We are committed and we are very happy that during the Slovak presidency, EU was the trigger of the agreement. Now we are doing our homework to be in line with the global efforts, but also to create opportunities for domestic low-carbon development. Thank you, moderator.
Thank you, Norbert. That's very helpful. obviously, time will tell in terms of the advancement of the issue that's been propelled this year, but I think there'll be questions about, I think, governance and accountability that emerge, which I will, if they don't come from the floor, I will ask, I'm sure. But I want to move on to Gerard. Gerard, you've been one of the key players in this particular game amongst many others, and you've been involved in producing, I'm trying to look through my paperwork, this very interesting report, for those of you who haven't seen it, the mission report which you submitted to the president of COP21. And in that, you talk about a number of things, in particular a soft collar pricing system, which will be interesting. But what I'm interested to hear from you is that how do you maintain competition and trade in the way that we had have assumed it to be in the context of low pricing of carbon as well. How do you balance those elements of preserving competitiveness whilst reducing global emissions? How do we do that?
Thank you very much for inviting me. First of all, I also consider that the ETS scheme and therefore the carbon pricing is the one of the best instruments to foster a low carbon economy, low carbon society. With Jean-Pierre Clamadieu, we have been fighting for many years in favor of a carbon price, and within the business dialogue, which had been organized prior to the COP21 as a place where the business has been discussing, exchanging with the ministers and ambassadors which were in negotiation. And within those panels, Jean-Pierre and myself, we have been strongly advocating for a carbon price. As Mr. Fabius said to us in the beginning, it was not in the mandate of the COP21. Nevertheless, it has been included in the final report of the Paris Agreement. We, the business, consider that it's a mean to give us predictability, visibility, and also a mean to simply quantify the climate. Without a quantification, how to introduce the right parameters in our investment decisions? In order to invest, we are in the energy sector, and by the way, the private sector will have to invest 70% of the total investments needed to reach the minus 40%. 70% will come from the private sector, and since the energy sector is responsible for 60% mm-hmm. of the emissions, we are completely involved. And therefore, in an investment to invest in renewables, in energy efficiency, how to quantify the climate issue without a carbon price. With a carbon price, that's easy. Now, after the COP21, we consider that there is a contradiction between the signals sent by the existing ETS. We have lots of discussion with Dominique Ristori, and the target set by the Paris Agreement. The target is minus 40% in the year 2030. And it's difficult to say if there is only one single carbon price consistent with the minus 40%. We consider that in average it should be between 30 and 35. Probably in the report that you mentioned, we are in favor not on one single and unique price in Europe, but a curve with a minimum price year after year, growing year after year, starting between 20 and 30 euros in 2020 and reaching 50 euros in 2030. So it's a kind of line growing with the years and time. Because today, with an ETS sending a message at 6 euros, that's clearly not enough. If we do not change the system, if we do not improve that system, we will never reach the minus 40%. Or it would be necessary to issue country by country regulations in order to close down all the coal plants, in order to subsidize massively renewables, to subsidize massively energy efficiency with the right carbon price. It's enough if we find the right level, and this is what the business is asking for. Of course, we need to take into consideration the risk of carbon leakages, and therefore to have the right instruments such as free allocations to the sectors which are exposed to external competition, such as Chinese competitions, Asian competition. So the right measures to correct and to protect some sectors which are highly emitters of carbon, such as the steel industry, chemical industry, cement industry. But the carbon price has to be strong enough to be consistent. And today, my message is very simple. There is a huge contradiction between COP21, Paris Agreement, and the target set by the EU institutions, the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament at minus 40%. So we need to improve the system, and clearly some progress have been made, and we had been working on that, such as the market stability reserve and backloading. But the carbon market, which is supposed to integrate those factors now, does not consider that it's enough, because the price signal is only 6 euro, and at 6 euro we will not reach minus 40%.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. I think there's a sense that we're learning by doing on this agenda. Whilst we've agreed a lot in terms of infrastructure and what a price might, the best price might be, there's a sense that we don't really know what the best price might be, that we need to think more deeply about what the factors are that are going to determine how we get to where we want to get to, but what the best pricing structure might be, especially when we know at the moment that the age-old argument on the climate agenda has been that actually you can't have economic growth and achieve climate change. And what we do know now is that, you know, especially in Europe and elsewhere, you can get GDP advancement and reduce emissions quite significantly. Europe's done really well on that. But that raises questions about the role of pricing, I think, more deeply. But we'll come back to that. I'd like to get reactions from the audience. Now, I'm going to come amongst you, if I may. Don't be scared. I'm going to pick on somebody. I want to get a sense of reaction to what you've heard, or what actually what you think the main concern for you is post the year that we are approaching, and we are approaching Marrakesh. Is there anyone who's got a desperate wish to put your hand up and say, my view is this, before I pick on somebody? You're all looking away from me. You're kind of nervous and thinking, oh my goodness, and suddenly you're looking down on your microphones, or there's a gentleman here. Say who you are. But we're not looking for speeches.
Thank you. Normally I wait a bit. It's Mark Johnston. I work freelance on this. It's good Paris enters into force in 2 weeks' time. We can only measure if we're on track, if we start to look at the numbers. So, Gerard, you started to do that. I agree with you. There's a big gap between the EU targets and the goals in Article 2 of Paris. But we really have to measure things and communicate those in meaningful ways in order to understand the position we're in. If you think of the 40% EU target on a 1990 baseline for 2030, sorry about perhaps too many numbers there, it's easy to do the maths. That's an average of 1% per year. So if we get to zero at the same rate, it would be the year 2090, not 2050, which is what the rich world ought to be aiming for, at least. So that 1% rate of pollution reduction in Europe, really, if you look at the science, it ought to be 3 or 4%. We ought to be moving twice as fast as we are now. The Commission's kind of stuck between all the member states, and the Commission won't move from the position we landed in 2 years ago. I kind of understand that conservatism in the Commission, politically, but we have to crack this nut if we really are to go forward and to start to close the gap that Gerard talked about. I need to get to a question. So when, let me try a question.
But you've made your point, I think. We need to go faster.
Question to Dominic. When is the Commission going to start publicly discussing about closing the gap between where we are and where we need to be?
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the other side of the room. Lady here, do you have a reaction to what you've heard so far? Would you prefer not to? Okay. Anybody else in the? Anyone? You're all. I'm sorry. I'm scaring the daylights out of you, aren't I? You're not used to this. Gentlemen here. I'm just making sure we're all awake and engaged.
Robert Cox, trustee, Friends of Europe. You suggested a moment ago that the age-old discussion that GDP growth and working for climate change were not compatible in the past, but now that there is a consensus that is no longer the case, that they are compatible. I'd like to hear a little more evidence about that, please, because I'm not totally convinced.
Okay. Anybody else? I'm trying to find... I'd like one of the women here in the room to ask a question. I'm really sorry. Is there anybody here that wants to put their hand up or I can pick on? No?
Amen.
Yes, I know. I've seen the person. I assure you I have. I'm trying to find a woman. Can I ask, Marion, can I ask for a reaction from you?
Yes.
Just say who you are.
I'm Marion Shern. I'm the Executive Director of the European Union Centre on Shared Complex Challenges at the University of Melbourne. So a long mouthful. We focus on climate and energy issues, and I was fortunate enough to be in town while this was on. I think we've heard a lot about unlocking private sector investment, and I'm still not clear how that's going to happen, because there has to be a lot of it. We're hearing the carbon price is not enough. What is it going to take? What is going to change investment in business models, etc., not just in renewables?
Great, thank you. And finally, yourself.
Thank you. John Cooper from Fuels Europe, and I'm sorry I'm the wrong gender, but
I've
got a question, a simple question.
Not the wrong gender, you're just overrepresented in the questions.
Okay,
that's
fine. Okay. Just like a short question. Everybody, I think, here is strongly in favour of free trade, and I also hear a strong consensus around the need longer term for clear carbon price signal, which is certainly a carbon price signal higher than we have today. So if we fast forward to 2040, and we've got a much higher carbon price signal in Europe, some countries and some regions around the world will also have carbon pricing. It looks like we will have some regions that do not have that. How do we do carbon leakage protection in a world with a much higher carbon price?
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I promise I'm not going to inflict any more pain on you in that way, but we just want to make sure we're all up and awake. I'm not going to ask the people to answer those questions at this stage. We'll do that in the open around once we've heard from other speakers. I'd like to move to Geneviève Pons first and to say from your perspective what you think is one of the big drivers for ensuring we get to implementation in a meaningful way from your perspective.
Okay, we have to come back to what Paris means, and the European Union is a party to this agreement and has committed to implement it. And what does it mean? It means that at least we must have 95% decarbonization by 2050. This has to be the starting point. And on this starting point, the policies must be aligned. And especially the 2030 package from the Commission must be aligned on this long-term perspective. And for the time being, it is far from being aligned on that. The main winner will be efficiency gain. And we must have a 40% target on efficiency gains. Right after that will come renewables. The needs that are now satisfied through fossil fuels, if they cannot be cancelled through efficiency gains, have to be satisfied through renewables, and especially through wind and solar. And this should be, the target for renewables should be much higher than what it is now. It should be 45%. And finally, as Gérard has said, the ETS should be aligned on the long-term target. And to be aligned on the long-term target, it should be very different, much more ambitious. A price of €6 is a joke. And it's not only a price of €6, but also free allocations and a reserve. So frankly, it doesn't play its role at all. It doesn't play its role as a signal for business. And the risk is not investment leakage. The risk is innovation leakage. What is happening already now is that the most interesting, the most innovative investments take place elsewhere. And there is a striking example of a cement investment, a very innovative one, taking place in India recently. So we should align on the reality. And the businesses themselves already have shadow prices, carbon prices, which are much, much higher than €6. They are presently at €20. So it's frankly, the European institution should try to get it right. And I would add something about carbon leakage. There are presently 17 countries or regions in the world which are experiencing carbon pricing. And Canada has just announced that they will adopt CO2 taxation next year. China is experiencing carbon pricing in many provinces. So these are, for the time being, pilot projects. But the wish of China as such is to adopt a carbon price. And there are states in the US which have already carbon pricing, like, of course, California. So we are in a world which is advancing towards carbon pricing, and it should be really a pity if Europe would not be in the lead on that, but rather would lag behind. That's it. Thank you
very much. I'm going to turn to you, Dominique. There's a lot on your plate and your agenda in relation to how the institution that you're working with takes forward this in a meaningful manner. You've got the challenge of the targets, you've got the challenge of leadership, and how do you balance the need to keep some sort of coherence across the EU when you know there's so much diversity in individual countries that's taking place. In that context, how do we implement COP22?
Thank you, Dharmendra. First of all, let me say that one year ago, I remember very well, many were still full of skepticism regarding Paris. It was not our case because of the excellent work done together with the French presidency of COP21, establishing a permanent bridge with the European Union, and also having the support and the vision of some entrepreneurs, such as Gérard Mestrallet, Jean-Claude Camadieu, who, before many others, pushed for the 40% reduction of CO2, and that before the negotiation for the energy and climate framework 2030. Then we had the agreement in Paris, the rapid ratification, as you said, extremely rapid ratification, and now the challenge is that of implementation. But in Europe, we have already our clear target for 2030 in terms of reduction of CO2, in terms of renewables, in terms of energy efficiency, extremely important. And I see many other countries in the world adopting the same approach. For example, regarding renewables, we have now 100, quasi 50 countries adopting national targets. Accordingly, it's an advantage for us to have a clear methodology of work with policy targets and the capacity to adapt the regulatory framework. Second, for implementation, adaptation of energy system will be key. because as you said, Gérard, energy is at the origin of between 60 and 80% of emissions. The production and the use of energy is representing a lot in terms of emissions. And what is important is to find solutions in order to combine economic growth and decarbonization. And this is possible. It is possible to decouple GDP and emission. It's a fundamental point. Third, to do that, there is no one miracle solution. Certainly not. And the present difficulties regarding the carbon price is a clear illustration of this situation. And of course, we will do all efforts in order to change this situation through the reserve capacity and so on. And I agree with the amount you refer to. But we should combine the reform of ETS with absolutely strong measures dedicated to clean energy and to energy efficiency. And we need for that massive investment, affecting generation for energy, transmission, distribution, and of course, demand. And we are attacking sectors representing a lot for business. And again, you have been with your company the first to open a department in your company only dedicated to energy efficiency measures. This is extremely important because we are speaking about sector, for example, lighting, for example, housing sector, having a fantastic potential for relaunching economy and at the same time developing clean energy. This is the way to proceed, and we will present soon, before the end of the year, new proposals revisiting our key legislative text in order to allow measures going in that trend.
Thank you. Before I turn to you, Jean-Pierre, I want Dominique for you to kind of respond to the two questions that we heard about. We had one about the science would tell us we should go faster than we are, and we should be going faster was the challenge. And the second one about more evidence about the relationship between GDP growth and carbon emissions. Are we absolutely certain that we've got that right? Even though the stats are very recent, we know that's the case, but it's becoming the case that they're much more compatible than we had thought in the past. Do you want to respond to both of those questions?
For the second, it's only necessary to look back regarding all the results achieved with dramatic reduction, important reduction of emission, and again, combining some key measures in the context of the development of clean energy, in the context of ETS, and in the context of energy efficiency. And the potential is huge to continue in that direction, decoupling GDP, because we need still economic development, we need still economic activities and jobs, but this is possible, absolutely possible, and at the same time, we have to build, based on the present methodology of work and the present clear energy and climate framework we have. We can still improve some aspects. As you know, we have already put on the table of the Council some key proposals regarding ETS reform in discussion. The effort sharing, the same, and you refer clearly to the present discussion going in a more positive direction than some expected even a few weeks ago. We will do the same regarding renewables, regarding governance, regarding the new market design. And we will do that very soon, but it is important to well prepare the things and to have in mind clear priorities regarding this new capacity to reconcile massive investment for relaunching the economy and reduction of CO2.
Okay. Gérard.
Yes, I consider that we have now a historical opportunity to combine GDP growth and decarbonization. It is the fact that the drop of oil prices, the drop of gas prices, the drop of electricity prices in markets, especially in Europe, opens a room, a window, to introduce a carbon price without increasing the whole cost of energy, and even a significant carbon price will not cover the difference, the gap, and so will lead to the economy a lower cost of energy. So it would, at the same time, could trigger additional growth thanks to the reduction of the cost of energy to all consumers, industry, sector, services, and introducing a factor to foster the shift from the old energy world to the new energy world, decarbonized, decentralized, digitalized.
Norbert, do you want to come on as well? And I'm not putting off your contribution at all, Jean-Pierre, I promise you, but I'm kind of saving you to last. Yes, go
Thank
on.
You. I'll try to be very quickly to reflect on both actually questions on size and on carbon leakage. Mm. I truly agree that we need to align our policymaking according to the latest science, and I think we're trying to do our best. We have to be also aware that we are working and living in a global world, and the EU share on the global emission is around 11%, and it will be under 10 in the coming years to come. So in order to be in line with the science, we have to work together and jointly. It cannot be only be the EU. You know, we will remain the leader. We are the leader, and I'm very positive that we will remain the leader, but we have to think in a global perspective. And towards the carbon leakage, I think it's the one of the measures how to protect the industry, because we understand there are some progressive industries and there are some industries who can, you know, get transition going in a much more, you know, faster and perhaps less costly way, because it creates new business opportunities. But we feel that decarbonized economy has to have all sectors in the game. Certainly, there will be some winners, but there will be some losers, and we have to make sure once there is no global level playing field, we have to make sure that we don't force the industry to leave to Europe. We want them to stay in Europe. We want them to invest in Europe, and that's why we have to take care they want to stay in Europe.
Okay, thank you. Finally, last but not least, Jean-Pierre, you're the CEO of a fairly significant company. I suppose the question that I'd like you to think about or address is that what will it take to shift the dial on this from the private sector point of view? It's one of the most significant issues to be addressed, and it goes to the heart of, A, on the one hand, trying to stimulate private sector investment in this, but really from your perspective, what will it take to shift the dial in terms of moving this forward now?
Thank you very much for phrasing the question this way. My feeling is that the dial has started to shift. And again, my view is really a view from the ground and from my experience as a CEO of a large global chemical company, convinced to be part of a problem. We are a large carbon emitter and we are working to reduce this, but also convinced that we are part of the solutions. We are developing technologies which help indeed ourselves and our customers reduce their carbon footprint. We have made an especially strong investment in advanced material, lightweighting material, which have a lot of application in aerospace, automotive, and so on. I think what was unique about Paris, and we are part with Gérard of this adventure, was a very strong mobilization of global business around these issues. Very different from what we've seen at previous COP, and we've seen we were able to launch with the support of Laurent Fabius a business dialogue, which means bringing on the same table negotiators and business and sharing views on what should be done. And I think that on an issue like carbon pricing, we probably were able to help put a few words in the Paris Agreement, which indeed should support the development of global carbon pricing mechanism. But it didn't stop there. I mean, in my everyday life, I see things changing. We are discussing with customers, we are discussing with suppliers, and sustainability and carbon is more and more part of the discussion, and not just with the people who are supplying us energy, but just as an example, we are a large supplier of Apple. Apple decided some months ago to launch an initiative to make sure that their supply chain will indeed contribute to the this fight against global warming, and we are able to find an agreement and take a commitment vis-à-vis Apple regarding the fact that we'll be using renewable energies in all the plants which contribute to the supply of Apple. I'm very much involved with the car industry. We are a large supplier of the car industry. I happen to be on the board of a large part maker. The discussion in the last few years have completely changed. CO2 emission reduction is the name of the game. Electric vehicle, hybrid vehicles, various technologies which can support the reduction of emission. This is today on the table of the board when it comes to investments in R&D, investments in actual production. So I think really Paris was a very important event, and we are seeing things changing. You are talking, Geneviève, about shadow carbon pricing. I would probably use internal carbon pricing. It's not really a shadow, but in our company, within Solvay, we've taken the commitment to reduce our carbon intensity by 40% in the next 10 years, and a very strong tool is internal carbon pricing. We have decided that we will use a carbon pricing of 25 euro per ton to challenge our investment, and it will lead us to make decisions. We will make decisions regarding a very specific investment to reduce greenhouse gases emission in the few plants where we still have significant carbon emission. And in other cases, I think we'll be much more prudent in making investments which could be put at risk if carbon pricing was to reach 25 euro per ton. So all of this, in my view, are very good news. Now, yes, we need to do more. And what we are expecting is to see the Paris Agreement turn into actual action plans in all the countries who have committed to do so. And we are just at the beginning of this process. In Europe, we are still working on adjusting the ETS to make sure that it gives indeed the right signal. And my view on ETS is rather simple. Let's achieve a system which gives indeed a carbon price, which could be a signal to make long-term investment, which means higher than what it is today. At the same time, let's make sure that in some specific sectors, we are not pushing emissions out of the EU, but continuing to let the emissions happen. And by the way, when I say out of view, it's not just China. I mean, there are situations where we could see production generating carbon emissions moving just at our border. And we have to make sure that we can quickly come up to a decision on what ETS will look like post-2020, because industries are effective. We can do a lot when we have a long-term vision of what will be the framework and what will happen to us. And this is where I expect to see rather quickly this decision being made. We are talking about China. Yes, China is about to launch a carbon pricing mechanism. They say 2016, now it's more likely to be 2017. We still lack a bit of an understanding of what will be the key parameters of this system, which will give us the ability, once again, to make the right decisions. So clearly, positive message in the sense that I think business is taking this challenge. And then, if we want to go further and faster, it's very important that Paris Agreement turns quickly into INDC being implemented and action plan country by country. We've said with Gérard that carbon pricing is key. We are seeing carbon pricing initiatives in various part of the world, Europe, China, Canada, you mentioned it. US is probably the player which is missing at the table, and I don't have much expectation that it will change soon. But we need to move on. We need to create bridges between these systems, the one which exists, to make sure that we will progressively move to a convergence between these carbon pricing mechanisms. And if I may make a last comment, a lot of people were a bit surprised and celebrated the the agreement on HFC phase out, which happened in Kigali a few weeks ago, last week in fact. This is a very good example of an agreement which gives long-term visibility, a level playing field, not in the sense that everyone will do the same thing at the same time, but phase out, which are organized in a way which put more pressure on more advanced countries, which gives a bit more time on countries which have specific situations like India. And thanks to this long-term visibility, the industry, HFCs, produced by chemical companies, we can adapt and develop the technology solution which will make this phase out possible. So in my view, a very good example of an agreement where indeed we are making progress with a clear global framework which allows us to align our efforts, our investment in research and innovation, our investment in terms of production capabilities, investments at our customers to make sure that we achieve a demanding goal.
Thank you very much. Jean-Pierre, can I keep you on the floor for a second longer and ask you the other question about investment? In terms of, one of the key things on this agenda is transition planning. We all need to be thinking about transition planning in terms of different models of business and different structures, and how do we achieve the targets while we do that. What's your sense of, amongst your own peer group of other leaders in business, investing quite significantly in R&D to think about innovation and innovative models that helps you maintain the margin whilst achieve reduction?
I think, as I was saying, we are receiving very clear signals from our customer. If I take again the example of the automotive industry, today when we have a conversation with this very large group of customers, the message is CO2 emission reduction is our key midterm objective. It can go through changes in the way vehicles are powered, I mean moving from internal combustion engine to electric vehicle, and it's not anymore a curiosity. I mean, this is a reality, and we are seeing our customers adjusting to this. Light bringing new materials, which makes it possible to develop much more efficient vehicles. We have very clear requests from our customers, which makes it possible for us to develop the solution that they require. And this is where I think the dialogue has changed very significantly. If I was mentioning our discussion with Apple on this, some years ago, this was not the subject of discussion with this type of customer. Now, sustainability is really part of everyday business discussion. And that's clearly changing the way that we look at this. Maybe another example to answer your question. Investors, what has happened on coal is very significant. When you hear large financial investors saying, we don't want to invest anymore in companies which are producing or even using coal, suddenly, it creates a lot of questions on what does it mean for you. And yes, we continue in some of our plants in specific situation to use coal. I can tell you that every time we have this situation, now it's a subject that we are looking at the highest level of a company. And I'm not saying that we will phase it out overnight, but we clearly recognize that this is a weakness and that we need to prepare ourselves to a world where coal won't be used as it is today.
Jared, I know you wanted to come in. Then I promise you I'll open it up to the audience more widely. But you're quite keen to also comment on this point.
Yes, first of all, I would like to reinforce what Jean-Pierre, I fully agree what Jean-Pierre said about the change in the mind of the customers and the public opinion. In the energy sector, we are in fact living a kind of triple revolution. Mm-hmm. There is a technological revolution with the photovoltaic, wind, heat pumps, and batteries. We are living also, like every sector, the digital revolution. But perhaps more importantly, we are living a cultural and societal revolutions. You know, there are two factors. First of all, the climate. Now the climate is in the mind of people, in the mindset, and it is changing radically. Therefore, our role as we used to be energy provider. We used to be a provider of commodity, cubic meter of natural gas, kilowatt hour of electricity. Now it's completely changing. By the way, those are commodities available in huge quantities at low prices. Our role in the changing world of energy, changing from centralized systems to much smaller systems, decentralized, decarbonized, and digitalized, our role is to accompany the change, accompany the shift from the old world to the new world, and therefore our role is much more to be the partner, the energy partner of our customers in this transition, the energy architect of the transformation. And so our role is completely changing. Dominic said that we had been among the first to create a full division dedicated to energy efficiency. And today we have 100,000 people totally dedicated to energy efficiency with 16 billion euros of revenue. To illustrate the change in the mind of people, more than 10 years ago, there was a poll in the US, and the population was asked to say to the question, where does electricity come from? And the answer would be nuclear, hydro. More than 50% of the people, US people, answered electricity comes from the wall. This was an illustration of the fact that finally there was no interest. You plug, electricity comes, that's it. Today, they want to know if it comes from coal, from renewables, from nuclear, and they have a preference.
Thank you. Very briefly, yeah? Thank you, because I really want to open it up to the audience. So,
I would like to come back to what Paris means exactly and how it happened. I was not only in Paris, but I was a few months before in New York. And there are very new characteristics in these international agreements. They are no longer the thing of governments. They are the thing of many players. If they are so amazing, because New York was amazing as well as Paris, it's really because many actors contributed to it, and not only businesses. It's really good that businesses are involved, and especially big businesses that can change the game. But the civil society was very much involved. And this has been commented by many international lawyers. The new agreements, international agreements, are made by many actors. And the challenge now is to pursue this cooperation, this broad cooperation of public authorities, businesses, civil society, to transform the world. And decarbonization in one aspect of the transformation. The transformation is much more important. I had the privilege to be with Jacques Delors in Rio in 92. In 92, it was not only for the signing of the Climate Convention, it was for the adoption of Agenda 21, which is the ancestor of Sustainable Development Goals. And there are three pillars. You can make it very simple: economic, social, environmental. Sustainable development is about that, getting the three pillars right and balanced. And we need to make a transition. The coal is the best example. Of course, we are shifting away from coal, and we must shift away from coal as soon as possible, because it is the highest polluter. But coal means social transition, because coal very often means one region working on coal, and directly or indirectly. So we must embrace together, all together, the sustainable development agenda. This is the real meaning of Paris. There were other characteristics in Paris which were also for the phasing out of CFC. The other characteristic is the bottom-up characteristic. If we could achieve this wonderful agreement, it's because governments were allowed to come with what they could do, what they could offer. But now the challenge is to put it in place. And this is a huge challenge. This is a governance challenge. Because we have to monitor the plans. Plans has to be adopted by states, and especially in Europe by member states, and these plans have to be properly monitored. Yesterday I shared with some colleagues a nice drawing made by a colleague in WWF about the governance beast. I would have liked to share it with you also today. I hope I will receive some of them. But it's not a nasty drawing, but it shows you how the challenge will be big.
Thank you very much. I've seen the drawing. I can attest to it. It's not that nasty. It's actually quite interesting. But you can, you know, go. I'm sure you'll have it on your website. Colleagues, I want to open it up to yourselves. Issues of pricing, targets, accountability are kind of things that I keep on coming back to, I think, on this agenda as we move this forward. It's over to you. Questions, issues. You have an interesting panel. You've heard what the agenda is, what the issues and challenges are. What are some of your concerns or questions to the panel or to amongst yourselves? Gentleman had his hand up just there. So please say who you are. And again, I plead to all of you, no speeches, please, or commentaries. Queries or to the point.
About Ryan European Policy Center. I find this debate interesting, the most interesting of all those that I followed in the last 10 years here in this. My basic question is simple. Carbon price and the price of the carbons that we use every morning in the cars on 100 kilometers of miles on Belgian streets, and the carbon we use for heating this room is the same. So therefore there must be a correspondence between the prices. And therefore my question is, how do we get higher prices for carbon in the real world? Why do governments resist of using scarce tax revenues to raise the excise taxes which we have? There's no need. The oil prices are lower than in the last, almost than in the last 10 years in Europe and throughout the world. They have gone up, or they will go up as a consequence of the recent OPEC agreement. That's fine, but that's not enough. So I ask essentially Dominic Ristri, what can Commission and what can the EU do, including to get Poland out of coal? What you said, We have had in the past much more regional policy and employment policy. Why don't we put a bit? Why don't we do a deal with Poland to accelerate their going out of their coal, out of their coal?
Sir, is your point, why don't we go for higher pricing? Is that your central point? Okay, all right. I'd like to take a couple of others. Tom, you must be awake by now. Come on, colleagues. Right, there's a gentleman there at the back. There, with his hand up, and the gentleman here also.
Good morning, Emile van Toorn, FIPRA International. My question regards the revision of the ETS directive. There had been a lot of talks about the tariff approach. Not in the Commission proposal, but there had been the impact assessment by the Commission, the non-paper also signed by Slovakia, by the way, and it also appeared in both reports and Commission opinions of the committees in the Parliament. Although last week it disappeared from the final opinion in ITRE, so I would like to know. What's your opinion on this issue and the expectation of this issue finally getting through in the Commission proposal? Thank you.
Okay. And then finally, gentlemen there. I haven't forgotten you. I will come to you. I'll ask the panel to answer, then I'll come to you.
My name is Hans van der Loof from the Global Resource Security and Resilience Initiative. I think there are companies already who are talking about CO2 prices that are well above 50 euros, obviously not where the ETS is bringing it, or even internal prices. There are, by the way, companies that do use $50 per ton as an internal price. My question is actually, the debate has been very much technical and supply-side driven.
Absolutely.
I will not make remarks about sense of reality, neither about COP21 nor what's going on here. I would just say that we are now in exponentially changing times. No longer linear thinking does not fit. But my question is really, you cannot address this problem without also addressing demand side, awareness and behavior. I think Europe on a whole, look at Brexit and look at the elections of 2017, will notice with the rise in populism that there is a dear scarcity in good communication, not only about the meaning of Europe, let's forget that on site, but this is a more existential topic. What will companies and policymakers do to actually drive behavioral communication and communication?
Okay. Thank you. And I will come back to the others, but let me give the panel a chance just to respond to some of those issues. Pricing. Why can't we go for higher pricing? A view on that? And also, in terms of nudging behavior, I'm glad you raised the point about the demand side, because I think often this debate always becomes about the supply side equation, and we really do need to be thinking about the role that the demand side has to play in this. So, Dominic, do you want to take the first in terms of that issue about higher pricing and why we can't go for higher pricing? And then other panelists, Nomad, you can take the other one. Thank you very much.
First of all, I see my former colleague, Mr. Ryan, asking for what we can do better regarding price of carbon. As I said, we have already done a lot in order to reduce emissions and at the same time to maintain economic growth, which is important. Second, the role at European level is to put in place the most efficient regulatory framework in order to facilitate the good trend into the right direction. But we have also to facilitate or to encourage additional measures in order to be more performant regarding these targets. As you know, if I take the example of transport, there is a lot of tax based on the level of pollution of car. And let me recall that finally, today in Europe, when we are producing one car, this car is consuming, in terms of average, not more than 5 liters per 100 kilometers. In the States, at the same time, it is around 9 liters. And we should be realistic. And this is valid for car as well as for coal. For car, we will not abandon the combustion engine from 1 year to a year after. Donc we have at the same time to push for electromobility and electric vehicles, first of all in urban area, where we have 75% of our population concentrated, and where we are the most, as you said, polluted and congested area. In parallel, we should continue to act in order to increase the performance of a combustion engine, the performance of tires, the performance of design, in order to pass to an European car not consuming more than 3 liters per 100 kilometers. And I think this is possible if we will use well all our capacity in research and development. Second, regarding coal, I was pleased, Geneviève, with what you said. It will not be possible to ask Poland to finish with coal from one day to the day after. Coal is representing presently more than 80% of electricity generation in Poland. But let me say first, many criticized Poland in the past, including in the recent past. I have to say, first, they have accepted the 2030 energy and climate framework. Second, they have already ratified, not only accepted, Paris Agreement, but they have been among the first to ratify Paris Agreement. Sometimes it's good also to recognize positive things. Second, they know very well they will have to progressively organize the modernization
of the energy sector, including a change in energy mix. And I will absolutely be in support regarding all actions dedicated to a sort of social treatment for all regions in transition. And let me say, this is valid for Poland, but this is valid also for all those regions in Germany, in Czechy, in many other countries using still coal. And this is fundamental in order to give also a chance to everybody, to all people in Europe, to feel positively concerned regarding decarbonization and the consequences of Paris Agreement.
Okay, thank you. Norbert, do you want to make a quick comment? If I could ask you to be brief, because I want to go back to the audience, because we've only got a short limit of time left now.
Sure, I will try. Maybe a quick reflection towards, you know, the sovereign right of energy mix and how to decarbonize electricity sector in all countries. I think we have to respect that, you know, if we really want to literally stick to the Paris Agreement, it says we have to be carbon neutral by 2050, and we have to leave to all countries choose their way how do they want to decarbonize their economy. And I think this is something that I think we all need to respect. Second thing regarding the tiering and the issue how to make sure that the most exposed sectors are at the highest protection in terms of the free allowances that are going to be distributed. I think it's still an open issue. In this particular tiering exercise, I think there were some perhaps misgivings that were found, and perhaps when we were using this carbon intensity and trade intensity as to two criteria, and perhaps they are not always the fairest. And that's why I think the general notion in the Council, if I may say, is rather to stick to the Commission proposal, to have a kind of binary logic. Either you are exposed or you are not. So if you go for tiering, you would still have very dramatic issues when you would be around some tier that you fall in or you fall apart, and it could create some controversies around it. So I think in the Council, I think their notion is to stick to the Commission proposal.
Okay. Jean-Pierre, demand side.
A few comments on this. We are all focusing on ETS and the 10,000 plants which are part of ETS. Fully agree with the comment that the next big challenge is really making sure that behaviors are changing. And there, I feel that there is not much political courage from government to tell people what this carbon pricing means. I mean, in a conference like that, we are throwing numbers, 20, 50, 100. Are we ready to make sure that our fellow citizens feel what it means on their own income and spending when it comes to transportation, when it comes to heating or cooling their houses? I don't see much willingness to do so. In France, I hear very often our Minister of Environment talking about the carbon tax that we have in our systems, but it's completely hidden. And the willingness of the government is not to make it visible to citizens for obvious political reasons. What industry can do on this? We still, in a number of areas, we still don't have the right way to measure the impact of our product, the impact of a supply chain. And working on this to give to the consumer the information they need to make the right choice, educate them, is still a big challenge. And the difficulty we are facing in our industries is that it can't be done just by one player. It's not just the energy producer. It's not just the material producer. We need really to have the ability to work along the supply chain. And I have to say we have not made much progress in past years about this ability to measure and give the consumer the measures they need, the numbers they need to
Indeed.
Make the right decision. So big challenge for us.
And I think that's part of the transition planning. I think there's business models, but it's actually about data and the quality of data consumers can rely on to make the choices they need to. I'm sorry, chaps, I'm going for an all-woman question round here, which I'm very pleased to have. So firstly, lady here, say who you are.
Yes, so I hope you're happy that I address your issue of gender balance.
Absolutely.
So I'm Alex Ball from Energy Cities. We've heard a lot from all of the speakers about the role of industry, government, and the market in addressing the implementation of the COP21 agreement. We heard about the triple challenge of digitalization, decarbonization, and decentralization. I would like to add another D, which is the D of democratization of the energy system. And a study was released not long ago by the CE Delft University showing the potential of energy citizens, and basically showing that by 2050, about half of the EU citizens could produce their own energy by 2050, provided that the right framework would be established at EU level for that to happen. So I'm just wondering, we've talked about investments, how do we mobilize all this latent investment, and especially also addressing the question to Dominic Ristori as part of the upcoming adoption of the winter package.
The community-led energy supply chain. Wow, okay, great. Lady here, say who you are.
Hi, I'm Susanna Galzamiglia. I work for DGGRC. And my question also touches on an element that I find missing in the discussion in connection with the questions raised earlier in terms of spurring behavioral change on the streets, and that's subsidies to fossil fuels. Why isn't that featuring in our discussion? And what can the panel say more about the merits and the obstacles in addressing this issue in that way? Thank you.
Thank you. And last but not least, lady here. And I'm really sorry, chaps, but this is the last round because we're running out of time. I do apologize.
Thank you very much. I am Maria Gaffo from the European Commission, DG Agriculture and Rural Development. We have discussed about this global carbon price, and actually a limited number of sectors or companies are responsible of a high share of emissions. So I wanted to ask if you see a role about the sectoral agreements internationally, trying to put sectors together, if there is interest on that in other third countries like China or India. And my second very short question, we have discussed a lot about emissions trading and the cost of carbon in emissions trading. We have now also the effort sharing regulation. The structure is different. We have a target per member state, etc. But there is also carbon price. And then also there are different mitigation costs, for example, for agriculture and transport, which are high. So I just wanted to know, how do you see the development of the carbon price in the two pillars? Do you think that there will be convergence, or how do you see? Thank you.
Great. Okay. Dominique, I'll come to you, I promise you. What I suggest is that as we're about to close up, for all of you to comment on those questions that you've heard, the democratization of kind of the energy supply, what's your view on that and the role of communities producing their own energy?
It's a very important point. As we said, we can now manage differently this new step in the context of adapting energy system in order to have, first of all, to give to each consumer a full command of his energy consumption, increasing the sensibilization of all, and also using better the role of cities. This was also absolutely new in Paris, with key mayors committed in order to implement in a positive sense all aspects of decarbonization. As you know, the mayors are closer to the direct final energy consumer, are closer to citizens. Accordingly, they are representing a lot, in particular for tackling renovation of buildings, because there is also a special responsibility, not only attached to European institutions, to government, but also to local entities in order to have clear priorities, and clearly the first priorities should be oriented in that sector to renovation of hospitals, of schools, of universities, of social housing. If we will do that, we will also reduce energy poverty, and this is crucial in order to finish with all people in Europe, all Europeans, having the feeling they are involved in this fantastic challenge. And clearly, we cannot do that in splendid isolation. Each level of governance has its specific role, and I see an increasing role, obviously, in that context for cities, We will, in our proposal, take that into account, including for prosumers. Anytime, this is also cost effective.
There's a difference between involvement and actually producing. And I think that's one of the key issues I think the lady was referring to, is that how do you get communities to be involved in the production of their own energy? But we'll move to that. Before I bring you in, Norbert, I'm going to ask Genevieve to come in first.
Yes, I am full of recognition of for some questions which were really very, very useful. Mm. Yes, cities are very big actors. And when I said we have to work together, including public authorities, among public authorities, cities are big players. Many cities in the world are more populated than many countries. And also democracy is easier in cities, so decisions can be quicker. And cities are big players, and they are able to move much quicker than big organizations like, for instance, the European institutions. So, yes, it's a really, really good thing that cities are mobilized now and acting rapidly. Then, phasing out of fossil fuels. Yes, of course. That's something... It's a kind of a scandal. And the money which is devoted to subsidizing fossil fuels should be much better invested in renewables. So this is a great, great point that you raised. Then democratization. If we want the citizens to be actors in their life, and especially in this transformation, we need to give them the right signals. And once again, it's about transparency, but also choice. So they have to know the energy mix of their providers, but also to be able to choose the right provider. That's what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Gerard.
Yes, I can also totally confirm that cities and the big cities in the world are taking a major role. By the way, the decentralization of energy, the use of smaller and smaller units, make it possible for customers, for the territories to take in charge their energy strategy and their energy future. I can testify and have the privilege to be advisor of the mayor of Shanghai, Beijing, and Chongqing, and the two latter cities, Beijing and Chongqing. Chongqing, by the way, is 33 million people, so it's three times Belgium in the population. They have asked our group to help them in the transition. And one of the most important manner to reduce CO2 emissions in the world is to shift from coal to gas. And we must not put all the fossil fuels in the same basket. Between coal and gas, there is a huge difference. Coal is emitting two times more CO2, but is emitting also particles. Natural gas, when it is used by a car or to produce electricity, emits zero particles. And, for example, for urban transportation, lots of cities in the world have been shifting from diesel, which emits particles, to gas, natural gas, which does not emit. And in Europe today, there is really a paradoxical situation, because the coal, economically, to produce electricity, is favored compared to gas. Today, taking into consideration the price of electricity, the price of coal, the price of natural gas, and the 6 euro carbon, 6 euro per ton of carbon, you make a profit when you produce electricity with coal. And you make a loss when you produce electricity with natural gas. And the price of carbon, which would trigger the shift from coal to gas, is today between 20 and 25 euros. So I come back to my initial message. We need a strong carbon price.
Thank you. Norbert, and then I'll come to Jean-Pierre. Mm.
My point of view is that we... just having a global perspective rather. So people are moving from fossil economy to diversification, fossil fuel economy to diversification, from diversification to decoupling, and now we are at the phase where we are coming from decoupling to decarbonization, and that's the biggest challenge. What I would like to perhaps bring in is the notion of the investment imperative. And I'm very pleased that I have the honor to sit here with the very progressive companies that are jointly working together with the EU institution, with the governments, with the cities, with all the stakeholders, with the NGOs, civil society, that we all actually do together, we do work together and bring us all on this decarbonized path, because without private engagement, I think the governments would not make it on their own, and I'm really glad that we have those companies with us, and I'm looking forward to engage and work with you all further.
Can you say just one word about accountability? Do you have a confidence that we're going to have the right accountability arrangements in place to manage this? Obviously, you might say yes, but honestly.
Certainly. I'm a firm believer of a European project as such, and we all started actually here in Europe. Who could ever think that the cap and trade would be really working, and all those regions in China and all over the world would replicate what we are doing in Europe? I think we are credible enough to see that we manage also accountability issue. I would also agree that perhaps our emission trading scheme is not the perfect, but it's a work in progress. We started somewhere. We are now at the phase 3, but we have already a vision for the phase 4, and we are talking about how to manage this supply-demand balance, because even the current depressed price is the issue of not proper functioning of the ETS, I would say. We had the biggest economic crisis that we experienced in the last decades, and the EU ETS was not prepared for such a crisis, and this bulk of emissions that were unused, simply they were passed to the third period, and I think it's the right time to do the right legislation, that we are prepared also for unexpected situations, and I think with the revised and reformed ETS, we can deliver that, and we can be accountable.
Thank you. Last words to you.
No, yeah, just a couple
some
of comments.
Yes. On a
sectorial agreement, I think it's certainly a direction in which we need to go. It's very complex. We've seen one industry, cement, making a significant progress. For other industries, example chemical, a bit difficult because we are quite fragmented, but it's certainly the direction in which we need to go. And very close to that, I'm associated with WBCSD, the Worldwide Business Council on Sustainable Development. We have developed a number of initiatives along supply chain, where we try to bring people who are contributing to one segment of the industry, and this is a very good way to start some collaborative work and move forward. And if I may make a second comment, just as I understand we are coming to the end of this, something has started on the road to Paris. I mean, from a business standpoint, things are changing, and yes, it was not just about business, it's really the civil society, which was also part of this. Let's make sure that the way Paris is implemented, and I'm not just talking ratification, but really each country is coming with action plan which supports their INDC. I think this should really make us able to go to the next stage. But I'm reasonably optimistic. I think that we are living in a different world, and we recognize it. Conversations are changing, priorities are also evolving, and this allows us to make real progress.
Do you feel that we've got the right conditions for the pace of technological innovation that's required now in Europe? Do we have the right conditions for that?
No, if not, we have what conditions, but we could do more. I mean, I think when we discuss about carbon pricing, this will generate revenues. Shouldn't part of these revenues be used to support technology development? I think that's probably a direction, it's probably something we need to think of. Some industries have been advocating this very strongly. We have a number of technologies, and I'm a bit more optimistic than Geneviève regarding the fact that Europe is still in a number of areas leading the way in terms of new technology development. We have to make sure that we continue to support this, and we have to make sure that there's the right conditions to bring these technologies from the lab to the plants and to everyday's life.
Thank you. Colleagues, that's all we've got time for, and I've overrun as well, so I've reduced your tea break as well. I hope you found that interesting, informative, engaging, and kept you up, at least. In the words of the suffragettes of a century ago, which had a similar movement of change, societal change, they said, deeds, not words, matter. And I think on this agenda, deeds, not words, are going to matter the most as we move ahead. Thank you very much for your attention and your engagement, and thanks to our speakers for really excellent contributions.